This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with SG2 experts and industry thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery. We're always looking for new ideas and topics from our listeners, so please reach out, share your ideas. You can email us at sg2perspectives@sg2.com or connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter, and you can find links to all that in the show notes. Now, on to this week's episode.
I do think that direct contracting has the infrastructure and methodologies in place that could make it a model for the future, so it could have a dramatic impact.
Hello, and welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I'm your host, Kelly Richard, and today we will be speaking with SG2 consulting principal and payment model expert, Tanya Bosco, and Intelligent Team payment and policy lead, associate principal, Brian Esser. Our focus will be on CMS's direct contracting model. We will discuss the key features and status of the models, as well as what these models mean for the future of value-based care. Thank you both for being here with me today.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you for having us, Kelly.
Let's get started at the beginning. We've been anticipating CMMI's direct contracting model for a couple of years now. Tanya, maybe you could just provide us with an introduction of the program.
Yes, we've all been waiting for the direct contracting model to get started, and it's slated to finally kick off here April 1st, but it's been a long haul in getting here. And of course, the pandemic last year played a role in that as well. Basically, the model takes some of the traits from previous programs like the Medicare Shared Savings Program, Next Generation ACO, but also tries to throw in some characteristics of Medicare Advantage, which most policymakers usually support Medicare Advantage and want to push organizations in that direction. So it does become Medicare's highest risk model as the Next Generation ACO model is ready to sunset at the end of this year.
That's a great place to start. I know that there's a couple different versions of this program. Maybe you could provide us with the options that providers have when they're looking to enter into this program.
Medicare really came out with initially two different options in what we'll call the general direct contracting program. And then there's also the geographic direct contracting, which is a bit different. Within what we're calling that general direct contracting model, there's a professional option and there's also a global option. So one option where there's 50% upside and downside. So they are moving into a symmetrical risk sharing arrangement, where in the past it hasn't always been symmetrical in Medicare Shared Savings. And that other option, the global option, is 100% upside and downside. So when you think about 100%, there's going to be a discount in that option so that Medicare can retain some of the savings, whereas that professional option is a little different in following more like Medicare Shared Savings Program without the discount. And geographic direct contracting, that third one there, Kelly, I almost forgot to cover that one because there's been a lot going on with that. It was in a request for information stage for quite a while. There was a lot of interest from everyone around that model when it was initially announced because Medicare was considering allowing technology providers and insurance companies and other non-traditional healthcare providers to participate in that and take on the risk for Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries in a defined geography. It finally was announced late last year when the previous administration was transitioning out. And so we got the details on it. They did only open it up to those that are considered a covered entity under HIPAA and limited it to certain geographic regions, still probably a couple fewer than we originally expected. That said, while we think this could really change the Medicare fee-for-service program, it is under review by the current administration currently. So not moving forward until that review phase happens, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Tanya, thinking about direct contracting, and let's just stick with the professional and global option, the introduction of capitation versus historical shared savings in the MSSP program, does that make you nervous for the members you work with and the clients? Or how do you think providers should think about that if they haven't been in a next gen or an advanced type program?
I think, Brian, it is a big change because we're moving to more of a prospective payment and capitation is required in the direct contracting model, be it in the professional or global. So two options, either primary care capitation, which is the only option if you go the professional route, or in that global option, you can do primary care capitation or what they call total care capitation. After everyone's experience with the pandemic last year and realizing that there's some risk inherent in a fee-for-service structure as well, that we're seeing more and more providers ask, is capitation the right way to go? So more open to it than a couple of years ago when I used to be afraid to say the word capitation out loud to our provider clients.
What did they say? We did that in the 90s. It didn't work.
Exactly. It did not work. But I think a couple of things are different now. We have a lot better technology. We have the data to really support the capitation, make sure it's set correctly. To answer your question more directly, it does concern me to push our providers to capitation too quickly without the competencies and infrastructure to be able to reimburse their providers. It's not as simple as paying the providers. You have to come up with those reimbursement methodologies and be able to distribute that. That is a big piece and maybe a competency that hasn't been there before.
Totally agree. But the other thing I like about the model, and would love to hear some ideas from you, is the incentive design. So capitation and really MSSP, it's always that lagging incentive. Like it's so disconnected from the performance year itself.
Obviously, Medicare Shared Savings Program has been that sort of lagged program in the past. And they're doing a couple of things in direct contracting, like preliminary reconciliation, because it is still shared savings ultimately. But I think the capitation and the degree to which you're willing to accept the capitation does help to get that prospective revenue stream into the systems. And so that's a big piece. And it's actually quite interesting the way CMS has constructed that. At first, we thought this is going to be, you know, just like an option that they had available in Next Generation ACO. And that's not necessarily the case. In that global option where you have that total care capitation, the capitation is actually driven by who you put into your direct contracting entity. If you put primary care and cardiology, you're going to essentially get capitated for those two specialties. But if you put all of your providers or have those arrangements with the providers, you could be taking institutional capitation, which is a big deal, quite different than primary care capitation. Really structuring that network is super important. And it gives providers some flexibility around how much of the capitation they can and want to manage as well.
That's great just from the perspective that not all of your service lines or your providers may be all that great at doing this. You can sort of pick and choose the better performers to a degree.
Exactly. It gives a lot more flexibility there.
I want to jump back to something that you had mentioned about the geo model. We had talked about previously, and I think part of the reason we'd really been anticipating that model is because we thought non-traditional entities might come in and start taking on risk for populations. We were thinking, what about those companies like Google or Amazon that have the deep pockets to do something like that, but maybe not the competencies? Have we totally ruled that out based on the HIPAA coverage that's now required for the entity that's assuming the risk?
I think it's made it harder for them, if not impossible, for them to directly do that because you have to be a HIPAA-covered entity. So unless they are a provider payer, someone who is considered a HIPAA-covered entity, that would be challenging. However, within the direct contracting program, the rules around the governing body of the direct contracting entity are much more relaxed in terms of percentage participant providers over Medicare Shared Savings Program. What that tells me is that there's still opportunity for partnerships with other types of providers and more so within direct contracting than there has been in MSSP historically.
That's great. So we could see some partnerships.
I do like the geo model, and I understand why the new administration may have delayed it. And like anything, both administrations put a lot of effort into this work, and direct contracting is something that is on a bipartisan basis, seems to have a ton of support. At the end of the day, we do have a Medicare trust fund issue, so I do think CMMI is going to review their portfolio of all their product offerings, probably streamline a lot of that, and ultimately have to end up in mandatory like we saw with the bundles. But geo may not be a mandatory sort of program on a specific service line, but is a geographic region that's going to fall into a mandatory new model, which potential forest providers to start managing care differently and ultimately impacting costs. It's going to be hard for them to walk away entirely from at least the concept of a GO. It may not look exactly like they had proposed, but they do need to push that kind of model forward.
I agree, Brian. Initially, when we saw that the model was under review, we thought that could be the end of the GO model, but we're hearing that it still may have some ability to move forward, much like you said. It may not look exactly like it was as proposed, but this administration may make some changes. It could still have a very dramatic impact where it is rolled out. And just because they've made it apply to HIPAA-covered entities, assuming that sticks, that still means that some of the major payers could come into those markets and essentially become your Medicare fee-for-service provider, because the way it was designed, all Medicare-eligible fee-for-service beneficiaries would get assigned to one of the direct contracting entities within a region in GEO. So it could be very disruptive.
It almost seems like at that point, you're mirroring a Medicare Advantage model by pushing it to the private sector.
You're exactly right, Kelly. It looks and feels a lot like Medicare Advantage. It's not gotten fully to the level of allowing benefit design and some of the beneficiary incentives that Medicare Advantage has, but it does layer those on and take it a step further than what we're used to in other programs. Medicare is really trying to push it toward Medicare Advantage, and that's why that look and feel is definitely there in the geographic model.
Yeah, I think that benefit design, and Tanya, I know you've worked with the Next Gen program as well, and just all the waivers inherent and that and how to use those effectively, whereas it feels like people may underuse the waivers and really the patient engagement tools at their disposal. When we were doing research, Kelly and I recently on some of the value topics, the providers that have moved away from value have sort of thrown up their hands saying, at the end of the day, I can't get my patients to really engage with me. I can put all the infrastructure in place and get the physicians aligned, but it's really that patient quandary. How do you get them interested in worrying about their care and really engaging with providers in a meaningful way? So hopefully, and I'd love your viewpoint on this, is direct contracting giving them enough of the tools they need to really engage the patients in a way that drives results?
I don't know if I would go as far as to say enough, Brian, because it doesn't get all the way to a level of a Medicare Advantage. That said, I think it's a big step forward in terms of what Medicare is allowing in those flexibilities with that program. They're definitely trying to get it closer to Medicare Advantage, and I think it's much more than we've had in these programs before. The number of payers and health plans that have been interested in this model kind of reinforces that fact that they feel like there's enough there to potentially consider this. So our provider friends and partners and clients need to be thinking about that too. And is there an opportunity to partner with a payer where maybe you don't have the competencies around disseminating payments to providers? So let's work with one or more of the payers in our market on geographic direct contracting if that were to move forward.
In thinking about the fact that we now have MA as part of the Medicare population, which has really pushed risk toward providers, and now we're kind of dipping into that traditional fee-for-service pool and pushing them toward the risk, what do you think the impact is of this program on the whole industry shift toward value? Are we going to get to the point where we have enough of the population that needs to be managed under a value-based contract that we see movement on the commercial side as well?
I think so, Kelly. The pandemic actually sped that up, as we started talking about at the beginning, that folks started to see the risk in fee-for-service. I'm certainly not here to say that it's going to happen overnight. And I still think we're at a pretty immature position in terms of the number of alternative payment models Medicare has out there and how do you bring all of those together. However, I do think that direct contracting has the infrastructure and methodologies in place that could make it a model for the future. So it could have a dramatic impact. It is still voluntary. So back to Brian's point, do some of these become mandatory? That obviously would speed up the pace of transition. However, we already are seeing commercial carriers start to go down this road too. A lot of the systems that we've talked with, even when they try to push the payer, when they're kind of reluctant, have said that the payers have been much more open to capitation versus things like shared savings that they've shied away from in the past. We are seeing that movement in that direction already from non-Medicare payers. We always talk about Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina and how innovative they've been and rolled out that capitated payment model during the pandemic to primary care physicians. So a lot of innovation that's come out of it as well. I do expect, though, to see streamlining. I hope to see streamlining by this administration to get more specific with the options that are available to organizations. But I think it's the right time environmentally with Medicare needing to do that, providers being more interested, and the larger payer system being more open than they have in the past going down this road of value.
One thing I would throw in there is, you know, we still have the goal of 100% of Medicare, either fee-for-service or MA, tied to some kind of value by 2025. So there's still those lofty goals out there. Whether we reach that or not, it'll be interesting. But then you also have the Medicaid space continues to expand, and with state budget pressures, need to be managed more effectively. There's going to be a layering on effect of the payers, at least on the governmental side, saying, how do we control our costs? But one question I would have, Tanya, and I'm thinking back just through as you've gone in and explained, like, here's what you need to succeed in value, from a good governance structure to align physicians to care management to IT. Now this is bringing in a payer element, at least in the claims. Do you have the ability internally to adjudicate, you know, on a capitated basis, these claims for maybe physicians that aren't employed by you? Is that a new infrastructure item, or is that one that you think is lagging behind the others that have historically been focused on? And how would you suggest providers think through that?
I think that's a gap. And actually, a couple of years ago now, we talked with some of the next generation ACOs around why they selected or didn't select, is more often the case, the all-inclusive payment, population-based payment. And most of them said they just don't have the competencies to administer the payments to providers. We see that you haven't had to do that with other programs like MSSP either. And I think it's going to be a big challenge. A lot of the systems that are thinking about direct contracting right now, though, also have a provider-sponsored health plan. So that makes it a lot easier. They're used to paying claims. And so they have the infrastructure, the knowledge, and institutional setup to be able to do that. That's a good thing. Those that don't have it, though, which I would say is the majority, is there an opportunity, again, to partner with a payer and or look at working with a third-party administrator just on a claims payment functionality as they move forward in the program? So there are ways to solve for that short-term gap as you build the institutional knowledge and competency to get there.
Great. And a final question for you. For health system leaders, how should they evaluate whether they should participate in this program and how?
That's a big question, Kelly, and especially right now. Medicare hasn't come out and gave us all the information we need on the Medicare Shared Savings Program in terms of those that are going to have to go into Pathways to Success, how they're going to handle the baseline years of 2020 and potentially 2021. And so that's one of the first things that we recommend is looking at, okay, if you have been in these ACO models, how does this compare to the direct contracting model overall, both in benchmark and your ACO structure and your attribution, because the attribution methodologies are very different, but really examining what your options are from an actuarial perspective and then making that decision. There's also a large piece that is your readiness to go into these models. So you may not have made the investment in infrastructure like technology and care management to be able to manage populations yet. Many have just stayed in the MSSP and used it as a learning experience. Those pieces have to come into your consideration too. It's not all just the financial and actuarial modeling, but big steps to be able to make that determination. And there's a lot more on the line with direct contracting, so important to get it right.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Tanya. Thank you, Brian, for coming on the podcast. And we hope to have you again soon.
Thank you very much, Kelly.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of SG2 Perspectives. If you like what you are hearing, please subscribe and don't forget to rate and review. We'd love to hear from you. Please connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter at SG2 Healthcare. You can also reach us via email at sg2perspectives@sg2.com. Reach out and let us know what healthcare trends are most important to you. Please also listen and subscribe to our colleague, Dr. Tom Villanueva's Modern Practice podcast on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. Tom discusses key healthcare trends through the clinical leadership lens. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening.